Good morning. Please be seated. Ladies and gentlemen, Judges Bea and Bumate and I welcome you to the Ninth Circuit. Thank you for a nice week here and lovely weather. You know, we thought we were going to get rain, but it's been beautiful. And some of us left places that were very hot, so it's been really nice. Anyway, I will call the cases in the, I'm going to call the submitted cases first just to submit them on the briefs, and then otherwise I'll call them on the calendar. If you are here for oral argument, you have a time designation by your case. If you're the appellant, that means that's your total time. So if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, it's your responsibility to keep track of the time. But if you tell me aspirationally how much time you would like to save, then I will try to be mindful of that. I'm looking at a monitor here, and so the clock counts down and then it goes up. That doesn't mean I gave you extra time, but it means you moved into overtime. But anyway, if any of my colleagues, if I or any of my colleagues are asking you any questions, you don't have to ask, even if your time is expired, you don't need to ask for time for permission to continue. As long as we're asking you questions, keep talking. Even if it's a hard question, you can't say my time's up. Okay, so that's the, so hopefully, I know you came here to say things, and we hope you have that opportunity, and hopefully all our questions will be answered. The last case done for argument, I know that we do have someone on video, someone in, and then some in person, and there is a split and splitting the time. So the person on video isn't there yet?
She's
listening?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Where am I going to see the person up here when we change?
You'll just see it.
Oh, okay. So if you are the, if you're splitting time, and I note that we've got one that's splitting, I'll discuss that with you when you come up and tell you how we're going to handle that, because it looks like it's the petitioner that's splitting time. Is that correct? Okay. So I'll ask you questions about rebuttal and I'll tell you how I'm going to handle that as far as that goes. So we have Dale Meeson versus John Taylor, AIE Services Corporation, 25-3552, 25-3800. That matter's been submitted on the briefs, will be submitted as of this date. The next submitted matter is Deborah Rena Graciani versus Providence Health, 25-4412, submitted on the briefs, will be submitted as of this date. The first case on for argument is Ryan Bradshaw versus Nancy Dahlstrom, Jen Winkleman, case number 25-4165, and each side has 15 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Bea, Judge Callahan, Judge Bumate. Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Nick Ferranti. I'm with the Northern Justice Project, and we represent the plaintiff appellant, Ryan Bradshaw. I hope to reserve, aspirationally, 4 minutes of time for rebuttal, and I'll be sure to that end to watch the clock.
What is your project that just, I don't want to let the time go, but is this a pro bono project or what the name of your that you?
Yes, we're the Northern Justice Project. We're a civil rights law firm in Anchorage.
Oh, okay. It's not a pro bono.
We represent Mr. Bradshaw completely free of charge.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, in advance, we appreciate everyone that comes, but we also appreciate it. We like to thank people that do pro bono work because it's helpful to the court in deciding things. So thank you in advance for that. And the clock wasn't running, so go ahead.
I appreciate the kind words, Judge Callahan. I'll dive in. When Mr. Bradshaw was sentenced, Alaska law made him eligible to cut his probation in half with good behavior. That was the law. However, the law was later changed to end this incentive. So here's what happened. The state of Alaska retroactively applied that new law to Mr. Bradshaw. They canceled his credits, and they prolonged his probation by 18 months. Atop those facts, the question before us, the question in this appeal, is whether it was clearly established that the defendants, by canceling my client's credits, violated the bar against ex post facto punishments.
I think we're pretty focused on all of that. And your client now, your client did not do custodial time. He got probation, right?
My client entered a plea bargain. He did custodial time, form of incarceration. He was then released. He had probation. And when he had probation, he had a 3-year term of probation that he was supposed to be able.
How much custodial time did he do before that?
From 3 years back from 2024, so about a year and a half. I don't have that committed
to
memory.
So none of that's at issue. It's just the probation time.
Exactly, and I want to be clear about that. We're here about the 3 years of probation that he was sentenced to, and he was supposed to be able to cut that in half.
Right.
He did engage in the good behavior. That's uncontested. But
the reason that they changed it is because your client fell within a category of, they changed it for people that had more offenses or something along those lines.
That's exactly right, Judge Callahan. And to laser in and be more specific, there was a credit program. It was 30 days, good time, basically. So 30 days of compliance will lop off an extra 30 days. And the law was later changed in two ways. One, it reduced that incentive for some offenders. That's not at issue here. Two, it also canceled the incentive for a certain class of offenders, and Mr. Bradshaw was in that class.
They gave him, later, partway, they did give him some credit.
No, Mr. Bradshaw has received zero.
He hasn't gotten any?
Zero credit for good behavior.
Okay.
So he served all 3 years? So
yes, Judge Bumate.
So we've got, there's Weaver and Lintz, and those are custodial sentences as opposed to probationary sentences. So maybe, you know, for me, how can we conclude that the law was clearly established as to probation when these cases were about custodial sentences?
Right. So I'll start with Weaver, because I think Weaver alone can resolve this case. And then if there's any question remaining in Your Honor's mind, then I'm happy to fill in any gaps that we perceive. So I think Weaver is what anchors us, and there are strong parallels here. I'll just rattle them off really quickly so we're on the same page. Just like with Mr. Bradshaw, when Mr. Weaver was sentenced in Florida, he was eligible for this incentive, this gain time incentive, where he could knock off part of his prison term with good behavior. And just like here, but even actually tamer, in Florida, they reduced the incentive. They didn't cancel it for Mr. Weaver. They said, hey, Mr. Weaver, we're going to give you less time, less good time from this incentive. And then just like here, Florida canceled Mr. Weaver's incentive to his detriment. And when the Supreme Court looked at this method of canceling credits, our Supreme Court, they had no problem saying that this violated the bar against ex post facto punishments. And they zoomed in on the method, and they said,
I don't think there's any dispute that the first element of qualified immunity is meant here for your client, that there was a violation of a constitutional right ex post facto. It's the second element, whether it was clearly established so that only an incompetent public actor would not have known about it.
Yes, Judge Bea, I agree with you that it is well established that there was a constitutional violation. I agree with you the question before this court is whether it was clearly established.
Casella versus Hughes tells us that you have to examine that question at a level of generality, which brings in the particular circumstances of the case.
Yes, Judge Bea.
Now, the next question is, do you have a case that says that Weaver applies to the cancellation of good time probation credits?
Yes, Judge Bea. So
which is?
Yes, I'd like to take that in two parts. So first, if there's any doubt about whether probation, the kind of punishment that Mr. Bradshaw was subjected to, is also subject to the ex post facto clause, well, that's answered in droves. So first, we have this court's decision in Collins, which clearly establishes that you cannot retroactively increase a term of supervised release, which we all know is just like probation. And then we've also provided this court with state law cases from Connecticut, from Arizona, from California that say much of the same with respect to probation.
I don't think that probation is just like supervised release, but I guess first, do we have a case on point yet that says on the facts of this case that it's ex post facto? Have we gotten that yet?
Yes, Judge, and I believe that we can come about that in two different ways. First, we believe that Weaver answers the question in courts.
You can come about it at different ways, and you can say that those cases stand for principles, and that's how we get there. Is there a case factually on probation like this?
Oh, I see. So there is not a case that exactly says Weaver in the context of probation. I want to be clear to the court. I don't want to.
And we still don't have that, right?
Right, but you don't need that.
Well, I know that. I know why you're going to say you still win. Okay, but I'm still trying to set the parameters of whether we've gotten, and Judge Bea said, okay, he thinks it's now, yes, that it is, that we might agree that it's ex post facto, but has any case said that yet about probation, like your case, yet?
Right, and I'm telling you, and I want to answer your question directly, no, there's not a case that says.
And then now you're going to tell me how these other cases make it clear to anyone. But, I don't know, incompetent.
Other than an incompetent officer.
Exactly. And just a couple things to rattle off. Judge Callahan, due respect. The Ninth Circuit has said.
Due respect.
Judge Callahan.
Normal
respect.
No respect.
Judge Callahan, no respect. No, I'm kidding. I will tell you that the Ninth Circuit has said that supervised release, parole, probation, they're all of the same bag. So I want to be clear about that. And I also do want to, I take your point. Weaver is not an exact factual analog, and I want to back into this. But we don't need to provide you with an exact factual analog.
That's my point. Like, Weaver is so clear. I mean, why isn't this just a case of obviousness?
Yeah, and Judge Bumate, I really appreciate the assist, and I'll go ahead and shoot the three.
Yeah.
I am totally with you. I think that Weaver does speak very clearly to the method here. And if there's any question, the question is, hey, is probation a punishment? And when we get back to that question.
Now that you've gotten the assist, maybe you need to deal with the people that want more than the assist.
Okay, we've got the defender, and she's hot on my tail.
It's very clearly established in the Ninth Circuit that if something is an obvious violation of a constitutional right, that amounts to a clearly established law. Right?
Precisely, and that's where I wanted, and not to resist Judge Bea's earlier question, the thrust of it, saying, like, how precise do we need to get here? But I will tell you, Justice Thomas said in Westby that, yeah, we can glean clearly established law from obvious cases. That's Justice Thomas's words. And Judge Bea, this was a while ago, but in Lee versus Gregory, you actually said much of the same thing. You said, hey, you implored all of us, use your common sense, and you, I'm sorry? you did not say, hey, gosh. But you did also implore, you said, there is no requirement that courts have previously ruled the very action in question unlawful. And I take your point, Judge, that was wise, and we agree with it.
And wouldn't that apply with even more more applicable in a case where the constitutional right is so specific and narrow, right? Normally, where we have trouble figuring out when clearly established law applies is the Fourth Amendment context, maybe Eighth Amendment context, where there's a variety of issues and that could happen and circumstances that could happen, and they arise in split-second decisions. Where here, this is a very specific right, ex post facto law, and it has a very narrow application. It's very clear what it means. So, yeah.
Judge Bumate, two points on that. One, whether out of an act of nerdiness or due diligence, I watched an earlier argument you guys had this week, the first one about qualified immunity with police officers. And I, at first I was like, oh no, this guy's making a great argument. But then I was like, oh no, we're all speaking the same language here. He was pointing out these great factual distinctions that actually altered the search and seizure or excessive force analysis for police officers because it was incredibly fact specific. Here, we don't have that. We have a method that we know is unconstitutional, and that method is what informs our analysis here. So that's the first part. The second part is, my friends with the state, they've cited Zorn. Zorn is a recent opinion from the United States Supreme Court, and it sort of reiterates what I was just saying, which is if you have a salient factual distinction, a distinction with a difference, yeah, that might affect the clearly established analysis. But if we know, if it's obvious that probation is a punishment, which it is, and if it's obvious that this method of prolonging probation has been ruled unconstitutional by the highest court in the land, which it is, then, you know, respectfully, we win. Now, I see my clock ticking.
Do you want just what it is? But how much time did you say you wanted to reserve?
4 minutes, Judge Callahan.
Okay, you're right about there. But Judge Bea may have a question.
How do you handle cases that were visible and legible at the time of that these officers were acting, which distinguished custodial loss of good time credit or loss of good time credits for custodial from loss of good time credits for probation? We had one in the Seventh Circuit, Sabo versus Erickson.
Thank you for asking that question, and I'm happy that you asked it. I distinguish it in a couple ways. First, Sabo, Seventh Circuit, I want to tell you that the presentation of that case has been incomplete, and I'm not casting aspersions, I think from both sides. One, there were factual distinctions in Sabo. One, there was a question about causation. That's a very big factual distinction. Second, there was a question about notice. So I'm flagging that for you to say Sabo wouldn't be on all fours, even if what I'm about to say wasn't true. But what I'm about to say takes the cake. Sabo's a case about cruel and unusual punishment. And the severity of punishment matters in cruel and unusual punishment analysis. It does not matter when our only concern is whether we are increasing the quantum of punishment. That's all we're dealing with here. And so the analysis is an opposite.
Well, yeah, and I thought Sabo was very different because, in fact, I think four judges said there was no violation of the Eighth Amendment. There was a concurrence by Judge Easterbrook who said there was no violation. If they said that there was no violation, how could it be clearly established?
Exactly. Exactly, Judge Bumate. And I'll tell you, we don't have that sort of argument here because I think it would be a very tough one to make. We don't have an argument that there was indeed constitutionality. So anyways, I'm happy to have eaten into my time with that good question. I do want to leave you with this. My friends do not contest that probation is a punishment. My friends do not contest that probation has been applied retroactively to my client in this case. And my friends do not contest that they did that in the exact same way that Weaver holds to be unconstitutional. All we've heard are distinctions without a difference with respect to Weaver, but really we've known for more than 45 years now, more than 45 years, that the method by which they prolong this punishment was unconstitutional. And all we're asking, we're not asking you to hold that, it's already been held. We're just asking you to reiterate that. So thank you, and I'll see you in a couple minutes.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Laura Wolf, representing the Department of Corrections Commissioners in their individual capacities. This is a personal capacity damages suit against two commissioners who administered the statute exactly as the legislature wrote it. Judge Bea, thank you for narrowing the question in this case on appeal. The question here is whether the legislature's change in limiting probation credits for probationers is patently violative of fundamental constitutional principles so that the officials implementing the law can be sued for damages in their personal capacity. And first, I want to focus on that standard for a moment, and then I want to focus on why, which I think will be helpful, especially to you, Judge Bea, because I know that you're distinguished. To you. Oh, sorry, Bumate, I'm looking at you.
Sorry, yeah.
I did the same thing. Judge Bumate. Judge Bumate, because I know that you're thinking of the why is distinguished, the reasons why you're distinguished in the qualified immunity excessive force cases. And I actually think there's a higher burden in this case, and I will tell you why. I'll tell you why because of the case law, and I will tell you the rationale for it as well. And then I will apply the standard here. So focusing on the standard for a moment, the general rule is that an officer who acts in reliance on a duly enacted statute is entitled to qualified immunity. We have that in Grossman. There's a really narrow exception. If the statute authorizes conduct which is, quote, patently violative of fundamental constitutional principles, and this court has said that the reason that narrow exception exists is so that officials don't have impunity for, quote, historical events like the Holocaust and the My Lai massacre. That's just what this court has said. The way that the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about reasonable reliance on duly enacted statutes is quite similar. So in Michigan versus DeFelipe, that's 443 U.S. 31, it's a 1971 case, the Supreme Court said, quote, the enactment of a law forecloses speculation by enforcement officers concerning its constitutionality. Now, there's a little M-aside. With the possible exception of a law so grossly and flagrantly unconstitutional that any person of reasonable prudence would have been bound to see its flaws. Now, that case, it's not about qualified immunity. It's a case about a validity of an arrest based on reliance of an ordinance that turns out later as unconstitutional, but the case is repeatedly cited by circuits for the qualified immunity proposition.
I would say that a big check in your side is that there's a statute that they were relying on.
Huge, heavy presumption, very heavy presumption.
Okay, well then now you have to defend why it's constitutional.
Well, no, I don't have to defend de novo review of.
Well, you have to defend. Didn't
you
say
that's the step one?
It's not patently unconstitutional.
Patently means so obvious. Yes, and I will absolutely, I will absolutely get there. But before I want to do that, I want to get to the why. Because it's not a split-second decision, there's a different rationale for qualified immunity here, and it's a really important one. The important rationale here is really democracy, because we don't want officials to, we want them to administer duly enacted laws, and we don't want them to not follow laws because they're scared of being sued in their personal capacity. And we also don't want the executive branch just abrogating duly enacted laws based on its own constitutional interpretation.
That makes sense. I mean, split-second decisions, the reason why we have that is because officers need to react and deal with dangerous situations all the time. But we're talking about prison officials and the safety of their office with lawyers that can advise them on the constitutionality of a law, and they could take all the time in the world to figure out whether or not this is right or wrong. I just can't, that doesn't make any sense to me that you would have a higher protection for those officials than those that are putting their lives in danger on the streets.
So the reason why I say the higher protection is not just what I think, it's what the U.S. Supreme Court thinks.
Yeah,
so
well, why does that make sense?
Again, what I said is it's democracy. We want people to rely on the legislature who's taking an oath.
Democracy is limited by the Constitution. That's not really answer to Renee, but...
Well, yes, but if you say that executive officials are on the hook for looking...
Don't we care about safety, public safety? Don't we care about... I mean, that's just a amorphous hot value, but...
They're just two different values.
Correct, and one that requires split-second decisions and one that requires deliberation and thoughtfulness. And so, the one that requires split-second decision, we should be giving more deference to than rather the one that requires, you know, deliberation.
What we don't want is officials being bogged down every time they're trying to... There's many, many laws and statutes passed in Alaska, right? And what we don't want is I need to ask my lawyer if this law is constitutional. We have an assumption.
Actually, why not? I mean, we do want our government officials to decide whether or not the laws that they're enacting are constitutional.
Well, I think that's an answer. I think that's an answer. But I guess in terms of the case law that I'm trying to like harness here, what does it, you say on the one hand you have where it's based on a statute, you say that weighs heavily in your favor. What does the case law say about split-second decisions? Is there anything, I think Judge Bumate has articulated his personal belief that the quick decisions where the life is on the line should be treated more favorably than when someone's sitting in their office in the comfort of a cup of coffee and a couple of lawyers down the hallway, that should put more burden on the official. Do we have any case law out there that says that?
So what we have is we don't have that comparison. Instead, what we have is stronger language in these cases showing that not only is there a heavy presumption, but a statute has to be so patently violative of fundamental constitutional principles, that just sounds like a higher standard than there's clear precedent on point about the federal law.
We have a lot of case law out there that it's, and I'm not sure that I agreed with it when he said it, but I'm thinking it while we're going back and forth, that he said, well, supervised release is the same as probation, or this is the same as that. So,
no, it's not.
A lot of things that are they the same as probation, and what is the level of generality that we need to be looking at here? Obviously, I think part of your argument has been that custodial doesn't automatically, isn't patently obvious that it applies to probation. But then but your friend on the other side says, well, we have things on supervised release. What's your position on this?
So our position is it's definitely not patently obvious. You can know this. First, the two trial courts in Alaska came to opposite conclusions about whether this particular law violates ex post facto, and that very strongly weighs in our favor because state court judges looked at this particular law to determine whether it violates ex post facto and came to different conclusions. When was that? Both in 2022.
But I don't think they both reached the merits of this question, did they?
They didn't reach the merits of qualified. They reached the step one question, not the step two of qualified immunity. They reached the step one. Is there an ex post facto violation?
A judge said that this didn't violate the ex post.
Correct.
What was the rationale on that?
They did an intense effects sort of analysis to determine whether the change in the. But we're not saying that that judge was correct.
I just want to hear what the plausible argument is.
It is in the excerpts of. It's an hour excerpt, the appellee excerpt, and it was that there was intense effects analysis, and it wasn't clear that the change in probation, dissimilar from it didn't talk about Weaver, but wasn't clear that the change was, I think, a detriment.
So I understand your argument to say that two judges, if they can't figure it out exactly the same, then they. People sitting in the Department of Corrections. And we confront this sometimes with judges on a panel that just because we don't agree, does that mean your colleague has lost his or her mind? Are they nuts or are there issues that are debatable? And you're saying that the fact that two judges couldn't agree.
Ms. Wolf, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
At the time that these officers were acting, was there anything in the case law which distinguished the form of punishment of incarceration from probation for the purpose of saying that probation was not violative of a constitutional right when it was changed? Was there any discussion of the difference between incarceration and probation with respect to constitutional rights?
I think there wasn't any case law saying that, a binding case law saying that they had to be the same in this sort of instance.
Not binding us, but any place else.
So not probation, but, you know, my friend on the other side says that Collins, which was about actually increasing incarceration and adding, like a sentence in court, adding incarceration and extra supervised release to a probation or to a supervised release violation, which is pretty different. In that case, that is like tantamount to probation, supervised release and incarceration with that is tantamount, and that's why we should have known. That case was also actually abrogated by the Supreme Court on different statutory grounds, but it's no longer, you know, precedential. There's other cases about probation, supervised release. I think they have three.
So I'm getting cases from your answer that the officers in this case, had they had the most marvelous AI tool and asked the question, is there any case which distinguishes incarceration from probation for purposes of ex post facto? Your answer would be no.
No, there's a recent case. There's a more recent case, Sabo, for instance, which is not about ex post facto, but it's Eighth Amendment. And so I do understand, and I, as a lawyer, appreciate that difference. And I'm sure, as a lawyer, as an appellate Ninth Circuit judge, you appreciate that difference. But understanding that there is a constitutional difference between, or four constitutional issues between probation and incarceration is something that a reasonable officer can think, oh, that actually makes a difference. And Judge Bumate, I know that you say, put this all into the legal application and take all these cases and look at them together. And I think, as a Ninth Circuit appellate jurist, that this is an easy case. But that's
Sabo
not the standard.
Sabo was post-action in this case.
Yes, what I said is Sabo was more recent. That was 2025. Correct.
I mean, Sabo, I feel like, is totally irrelevant here because all these judges thought that there was no violation of the Eighth Amendment there. So clearly it can't be clearly established.
There are other cases from other courts. For instance, there's a well, there's a great case in the Second Circuit that we didn't tell you about. It's Connecticut versus Crotty. And it cites Grossman, your decision in Grossman. And it says that there was a statute about non-resident shellfish fishing and was struck down. And then there was another statute about non-resident lobster fishing. And the question was whether the non-resident lobster fishing should have known that this was, you know, clearly unconstitutional. And, you know, there was a little bit of a difference. There's a little difference in the geographic area. And the court said, the Second Circuit said, while a distinction without a difference insofar as the privileges and immunities analysis is concerned, this distinction is sufficient to muddy the waters for purposes of qualified immunity by casting doubt in the minds of reasonable officials about whether invalidation of the non-resident shellfish law would translate into invalidation of the non-resident lobster law.
And that's a privileges and immunities case, right?
Yes, it's
different. Completely complicated. It's an amorphous right that has not been clearly delineated by this court. But we have the ex post facto law, which we know very clearly the contours of it, right?
Not exactly. I mean, the Supreme Court has said...
Not exactly. Do you agree the ex post facto law applies to probation?
Do I agree the ex post facto law applies to changes in probation?
Yes.
Probably, but it's not clear, I would say.
Okay, what case casts that into doubt?
I think the fact that all of the Supreme Court cases are about lengthening incarceration, and then... that this area of law is not as simple as you might think, and that this.
What about if, like, they pass a law that says everyone that's on probation for child pornography, a condition of their probation is they can't have a computer. Okay, so would that be an event so that everyone would then that be an ex post facto?
I don't know. Ex post facto law is actually more difficult than I think, Judge Bumate, you imply. I think what Mr. Bradshaw wants...
is there any case that casts doubt that probation doesn't apply to ex post facto apply doesn't apply to probation?
So the question is not whether there's a case that casts doubt about how to apply and expand and extrapolate Weaver and to look at different cases from different courts and try to fit them together in a lawyerly synthesis. That's not the question. The question is whether an objective, every objective, reasonable commissioner should have known that this is so flagrantly, so patently violative of fundamental constitutional principles that it violates ex post facto.
Exactly.
That's a high burden.
I agree with that, but this is so obvious.
So... for you, it is so obvious.
Yes,
I've
not heard any reason to doubt that it's not obvious.
If I could just wrap up for a moment, because I see my time is up, I want to show you why it's not obvious, all the different steps you have to take.
Okay.
So the appellants say that you should have reviewed Weaver, looked at the holding on a high level of generality, not the actual holding, which is eliminating good time credits that would reduce incarceration is a violation of ex post facto, but extrapolating on a higher level of generality. And then, although probation and incarceration is a mighty big difference, a difference to many other constitutional provisions that courts have found, maybe even this provision, they want you to say, well, you have to do that lawyerly analysis. And then the commissioners also should have known by reviewing Collins, which is actually not a case about probation. It's a case about supervised release and a sentencing court adding supervised release terms and incarceration after a violation of supervised release and say, well, that's really similar. And also that case was abrogated by the Supreme Court, but don't look at that. I want you to do all of this lawyerly synthesis and then also disregard the fact that two Alaska trial court judges came to opposite conclusions. One of them must have been incompetent because that's the standard, right? That is not what we're looking for, that lawyerly synthesis. And while it's true that for the purpose of qualified immunity, we charge officials with knowing binding legal precedent, that doesn't mean the officials turn into lawyers and know how to combine different cases and understand how to apply the rules in the way an esteemed Ninth Circuit jurist does. That's not the standard. And so because of this, the legislative changes in the probation credits, it was not so patently violative of fundamental constitutional principles, such that the commissioners who administered that law should be held personally liable. And we ask this court to affirm the dismissal on qualified immunity grounds.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, judges.
I'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to add a little bit
I appreciate that grace, so, Judge Callahan. I'll try to be quick. First of all, it was conceded by the defendants at the appellate level, the trial level, that probation's a punishment. Unless there's any doubt, Griffin v. Wisconsin, the United States Supreme Court, referred to probation as a punishment. Smith v. Doe, the United States Supreme Court, referred to probation as a punishment.
Is there any case that specifically applies ex post facto law provision to probation?
Smith v. Doe is an ex post facto case about registry requirements, and in the contrast, they said, hey, look, probation is the archetypical punishment. So I think it's not nearly as complicated as my friend Ms. Wolf makes it. I think we look to on-point case law from our Supreme Court.
If we were to publish on this, and because I don't think that there's anything exactly out there that's saying that. Let's say if we were to publish and say that ex post facto applies to probation, and then it would be really clearly established, right? But how should we draw the lines on that? Should it be conditions of probation, that if you change conditions of probation, that's ex post facto? Or what would the law be?
The way that I would write it is I would just refer to the quantum of punishment being increased, and to laser in, that's the time that someone's spent on probation being increased. And the reason I would say that is because I wouldn't want you to get into a thicket where you're talking about conditions, like you mentioned, for instance.
Right.
Yeah. So. Just the time. And that is clearly established. That is obvious. So you'd be reiterating that.
You're engaging in exactly the level of generality talk which we're told not to engage in, which is saying incarceration equals punishment. Probation equals punishment. So therefore, let's talk about punishment. Let's not talk about probation.
Judge Bea, I respectfully disagree, and I believe that your circuit's precedent would disagree. This methodological approach is well-established, it's well-heeled. I would just, court's indulgence, I'd like to read to you what the Ninth Circuit has said, not once, but six times. The Ninth Circuit has said, we routinely rely on the intersection of multiple cases when holding that a constitutional right has been clearly established. It's nothing new under the sun to look at two things and say, oh, probation's a punishment, A, and B, the method of prolonging this punishment is clearly established to be wildly unconstitutional. I think there's nothing wrong with that, and we're not somehow upsetting the careful balance of qualified immunity when we hold something
when
so obvious.
When someone's charged with a crime, and of course they want to be found not guilty, that would be their first choice. Their second choice would probably be probation, and their last choice would be custody, prison, or so. Do people coming to court actually think that probation and incarceration are the same?
I think that they both.
Would your client, like, if you have a client that's charged with a crime?
I was taught to
would
never
they say, like, "Oh, hey, I've got good news for you. You get to go to prison," or "I've got good news to you. You get to be on probation." What would they think?
I was taught to never fight with a hypothetical, so I'm gonna acknowledge first, Judge. Yes, they're different, and I will never argue to you that they are not different. But the key point for the purposes of this appeal and this analysis is that they are both punishments, and we have increased the quantum of punishment, the quantum, that's not my phrase, that's the Supreme Court's phrase, the quantum of punishment. So I could go on forever. I'm happy to answer more questions, but I also want to be respectful of your time. So.
What's up with the district state judge that said that this was not a violation of the ex post facto law?
Yes, a couple things. One, the state court judge
who clearly incompetent.
I would never say that about our great state court judges in Alaska, even on my tiredest day. But I will tell you that the judge manifestly erred there. And if you go back, it's in the supplemental excerpt of record. There are two decisions. The one decision, it used this purpose and intense effects test, and it came to the conclusion that maybe probation was a civil regulatory scheme. That's contradicted by on-point precedent. It was It was completely wrong. And it's not at issue here because that's only the threshold question, which goes back to even like the Sabo question, which is, have we done enough here to make it a punishment? It could be the worst punishment on earth, or it could be a lesser punishment. The only point is we're increasing it, and we're all on the same page here. Even my friends with the state, we're all on the same page that it is an increase. So again, I want to be I would love to keep talking, but.
Well, thank you for your argument.
Thank you so much, judges. I really appreciate your time.
Added greatly to the argument, and occasionally arguments can be fun too. And so it doesn't mean that we don't
occasionally
take them seriously. Well, we don't, we take them seriously, but good humor can
take good care. I hope you enjoy your time here.
Thank you.